Mr. Ellis, reel three.
At Nîmes, we were winding up with the Mackey. They were getting themselves organised in various spheres. One or two little incidents across cropped up. One, I had to give my first morphine injection of the war. One of our chaps went against all instructions and carried a Sten gun around with a round up the spout, and of course it went off and shot him in the knee. And so they got me to give him some morphine. We, as part of our earlier ops, had coordinated a bit of bombing and strafing of Room 9, and this was done principally by the Fleet Air Arm. And we found a young naval lieutenant who had to bail out when his aircraft fouled. And we looked after him and repatriated him via Marseille to his ship. It was he was fortunate in one extent, in as much that he was married and his young wife was expecting a child any time, and of course he was officially missing. And with my contact straight back to London, we were able to send her a message that he was alive and well and being repatriated, which was rather nice. We also sent him back with a few things for the baby, which we bought from the local shop, and a couple of things for his wife. I thought naval officers especially were were men of the world as far as the other sex and that were concerned. And I had a most amusing time in this clothing shop. We were trying to get a blouse and something for his wife, because there he was, very red-faced, and Madam was asking what size she was, and he didn't know her sizes, so typically French, she went out and got three or four ladies off the street to come in, different sizes, you know, which one is that? And he wouldn't face them, but turn his head and look and said, oh, the one near there. And there she would, she calmly stripped off her blouse and tried on this new one for him to see. And I've never seen anybody so embarrassed in my life. I found it hilarious. My sense of humour, I suppose. Where he went off. And after two or three days more, we, mostly of jollifications, we said goodbye to our Mackie comrades. We then went up north, where we were to go to Lyon, to join the debriefing thing. Went via Valse, where I had my first white bread for 4.5 years, and then into Lyon. At Lyon, we SOE had set up a headquarters for JEDS, where we handed all our gear in, or surplus gear, like our radios and that, which we didn't want to cart around. And we were to be reorganised. Now, Major Sharp, as I previously said, had many irons in the fire, and he just said, right, well, I don't need a radio operator anymore. I'm off on my intelligence corps duties now elsewhere. You can do as you please. Well, due to my being bombed out before I went to abroad, I obviously wanted to go back to London. So we agreed on this. Unfortunately, the night that he was due to go, he'd loaded all his stuff in his Citroen, left it at the front door with a couple of guards, Mackie guards on. Even so, the whole lot was gone in the morning. So we spent another day trying to find him fresh transport, and of course he'd lost everything that was in the car. He went, and then I managed to get a pass to go with a couple of agents up to a US Army Air Force fighter field near the Swiss border at Braun, if I remember rightly. And they had a Mitchell bomber, which they used for transport purposes, mostly for taking parties up to Paris for weekends. And they gave us a lift to Paris, to Le Bourget. Unfortunately, Le Bourget, the King's Messenger plane, only had two seats on, so these two agents took those, and I was left without any documentation. So they got me into Paris. And although I found the right house, or the right office, nobody professed to know anything about JEDS or SOE. The chap who concerned was out for a protracted lunch, as it turned out, later. So I had to go round to Army HQ, and before I knew it, I was in before the Brigadier himself, and I had to spin him my yarn, of which, as you've probably learnt by now, I was only able to give a synopsis. I wasn't allowed to give any detail, etc. My brief to get back to England was anybody should have knowledge of JEDS, or they could ring room 98 at Horse Guards Parade and give my name and number, and the rest would be done. Anyway, the had no way of doing that from Paris, but the Brigadier, he really enjoyed having a yarn with me, and he gave me a pass to stay in Paris and also a pass to fly back from Le Bourget, which I did the following day. I also had a little bit of luck at Le Bourget airport, because I still had French expense money. I had no English money, and I didn't know how I would get on in England. But some RAF officers had just come out, and they wanted to change some money for francs for the night out in town. So I did quite a deal with them that helped out. I flew back in the King's Messenger plane, the Dakota, to Croydon. And most of the passengers on that were ex-RAF prisoners of war being repatriated. And when we got in, the King's Messenger disappeared. These chaps were briefed through in no time at all, and then the intelligence officer got on to me. I'm afraid I hadn't got very much going for him.
Why not?
He just would not listen to reason. He wanted to know everything, and I just said, no, I'm sorry, I can't. First of all, he couldn't believe that I didn't know where my headquarters were. And at that time, I had no idea that Milton Hall was still being used by us or not. I knew that there was a flat in London. I knew that there was Baker Street. But as far as I was concerned, I had exactly the same information as I was able to give him. Ring the War Office, ring room 98, and they would do the rest. And he wouldn't do that. And he went on for about 2 hours. In the end, he had to give in, and well, you clear off. If you've not joined your unit by 24 hours, I'll have everybody out, which was the most stupid saying you could have, because he didn't know where I was going, I didn't know where I was going, and he couldn't keep tabs of me. Good thing out of it was that his sergeant took me along to the customs, and they'd gone home for the day, so I didn't have to go through customs, which was a help. And I got dumped off at Hyde Park Corner in a very hotchpotch uniform, dirty and dishevelled, armed, a suitcase and a Bergen rucksack.
When was this?
And that was on 16th of September, 44. Taxis didn't want to know me until a couple of Australian swaddies came along. They got a taxi and they insisted on sharing. I went down to the flat that I knew, and there was nobody there.
Where was the flat?
That was somewhere off of Soho. I don't know the address now. My other home in London was Royal Armoured Corps Club in Grosvenor Square, which is now the American Embassy. I hadn't wanted to go there first because there was a rule about taking arms and ammunition there. You're not supposed to. Anyway, I ended up there and I was greeted very much as an old friend and taken in. And then the evening I managed to contact my people, and the following morning go round to one of our places in Bryanston Square, which backs onto Baker Street, and see the HQ staff. They gave me a stenographer and gave me a complete debriefing for about 3 days. I think it was more like a Hans Andersen story than debrief, but they showed it around to all and sundry, apparently, at the time.
You mean made up, invented?
Well, let's say that my memory at the time was a lot less clear than it is now. Maybe it's my life since then has made me more concise in my putting together of things than it did. Time didn't mean a thing to me. You know, at the time, I reckoned I went in June, but of course I couldn't have gone in June because we know that D-Day was June the 5th, was it, or 6th?
June the 6th.
June the 6th. And I was in England then, so... And... from there, I went up to, they sent me up to Milton Hall, which was still in being, and I went on leave then for a few weeks.
Who did the debriefing with you? Can you remember the names of the individuals?
No, I wasn't given any officer at all to debrief to. I was just given a stenographer and to tell her everything there was. I am really annoyed with myself because the colonel in charge up there was a charming chap and I don't know his name. I would love to.
Going back to France, when the communist resistance got hold of you, did you have anything on you to show, prove that you were British?
Oh, yes. We all carried... a document from General Koenig.
You're just showing me it now.
Yes.
Piece of paper.
Yeah, which was a pass asking for cooperation of the French people. It had to have General Koenig's name on because certainly in the southern half of France, General de Gaulle was treated the same way as Germans rather than French.
It's got English on one side and French on the other side. It's a kind of laissez-passer with your name at the top, Sergeant J.W. Ellis, and number 89 as a number at the top. So you show the communist resistance this?
Yeah.
But it meant nothing to them?
No.
Maybe the name Koenig was a provocation to them?
Possibly, although it was supposed to be the sympathetic... name for them, but then of course the communists, as I found out afterwards, really didn't want any interference from anybody outside of the area.
What else did you have to show them?
Nothing at all at that time, other than my pay book, which would only tell them that I was a British soldier, Sergeant Ellis.
You said earlier that the French in Algiers had turned out to be less pro-British than they appeared in London, in Britain. Can you expand on that, please?
Yes. When we met our French officers and our French counterparts in England, they were all extremely friendly. We all went out together, drinks, what have you. To such an extent we even went to church together, because in Peterborough we had found a Methodist church, a very big one, and in it a choir and a soprano in that choir who, in our opinion, could have graced Scala Milan or something like that. She had a really wonderful voice. And we went back and told these boys. So following Sunday, they all came with us. And that put another 100 people into this church. And she sang her solo bits in the hymns. And they all got up and shouted bravo and clapped and that. But, you know, we were that friendly. But when we got to Algiers, which was obviously French, within days, you know, bloody British, we don't want you in our country, don't know why the bloody hell you are, and various things like that. They just made life as uncomfortable as they could for us.
What was the explanation for it?
Well, the only explanation that I can put down to it was what I found in the whole of southern France, and I've found a lot amongst Frenchmen since, was that they never forgave us for sinking their fleet in the Mediterranean. And we bombed various French places as part of the war.
Would this come up in your presence?
Oh, yes. Mm. Yeah.
Did you try to defend it?
No, all I would ever say was that I understood the fleet was destroyed with the minimum loss of life so as it wouldn't fall into the German hands, you know. And as, you know, the French wanted to defend themselves later on and they weren't in accord with Pétain's government, you know, that. One golden rule for all of us was to keep out of politics. The second golden rule was to keep away from the women. Because the women were really the ones behind the leaders in all the Mackies and that who ran things. There's more petticoat rule than anything else, in my opinion.
How did that show itself when you got there?
Oh, the way the women who we knew were liaison with the French leaders tried very hard to get Major Sharp and myself into their beds and to get our favours and what have you. Oh, yes. And we also found that if an odd remark had been made or something, it went wrong way.
How do you mean?
Well, if we said something about the women and or somebody's command or something like that, it got turned round and against us. You know, you found that the men would not admit that the women were controlling them at all, and the women wanted it the other way. It's a bit difficult to describe. That was certainly our feelings at the time. For example, down in Nîmes, we'd been out to dinner and the major had been set on by two of the women, and as we got up to his hotel room, they were both wanting to go into his room with him, you see. And he just turned around and says, Johnny, good. We've got to get these messages done tonight. Well, we weren't doing any messages. You'd better come in. And said, sorry, ladies, you know, we've got work to do, and shushed them off. And then, of course, when I got inside his room, he says, I don't want you for anything. He said, we've got to get rid of those two somehow, you know.
Why were the women so determined to get into bed?
Well, they thought that was the best way to control people. It's the age-old problem. Women all through the ages have always used their sex to control men.
Now, can we go on to how you came to go to Malaya?
Yes, okay. Briefly, all of us, when we returned from our leave to Milton Hall, were asked whether we would continue to volunteer for duties out of the Far East on the same principle as we had in France. And all bar two said yes, we were going to get enhanced danger money and extra pay and that kind of thing as well, but that wasn't really it. We by now were professional troops for that kind of job, working behind the lines. I won't say it held no fears for us, but it wasn't a strange experience anymore. So we said, right. And we shipped out in two lots then, on a trooper to India. India down to Ceylon, where we had a base. And from that base, we made up new teams. We didn't go as teams at all. We went out as operators, and officers came from everywhere again, because lots of the officers in France never went out east at all. Major Sharp didn't, for example. Made up new teams, and we went out and did concentrated jungle training, because this is what our new habitat was going to be. Operating the tropicalized B2 sets, which we all had then, out in the jungle was completely different from anything else we'd done, so it needed quite a lot of practice. And then after two or three months of this, teams started mostly to go into Burma as teams. And I hadn't got in with the team at all and was being used as a senior operator to go out with odd teams to make sure that they knew what they were doing. And I went out on a jungle scheme one week, and the referee on the first evening said, are you all right? So I said, yeah, I've only got a good dose of squid, I should be all right. And the officer who was in charge of this particular group said, oh, of course he's all right, we get on. Well, I wasn't all right, and I was a damn fool. I went off with them, and I was half carried for a couple of days. The Burmese plainsmen, who were the worst ones I found out of the natives out there, were there, didn't want to know me. There was an interpreter, Chinese interpreter with them. He was the one who looked after me. And in one of my lucid moments, he said, you've got to get help. So he said, if I set up for you, can you tune it and get a signal off? So
Where was this?
This was in northern Ceylon, in the jungle. Virgin jungle up there at that time. And I got the message off, and Major Rosenberg, who was our chief instructor, he motored the 300 miles out from camp up there, and in the middle of the night was trying to find his way down jungle paths with a torch to find me. And in the morning, they eventually did locate us and got me off. He got some transport, took me off to the RAF hospital at Sigiriya. It was a small airstrip in Ceylon. And I had dengue fever. When I got into hospital, apparently I had 108 temperature. I was in the hospital for 3 weeks. For most of that time, I couldn't even read a playing card. My eye nerves had gone so bad. And anyway, at the end of the 3 weeks, I was relatively well. So they packed me off down to Colombo to get back to base. They sent me for a week a little rest camp we had down on the beach, where I could canoe and swim and do all the nice things. Then I went back, and they said, "Ah, fine, glad to see you back, etc." Now, in this base camp of ours, we had a beautiful American trailer with RCA transmitting and receiving equipment in, which they use for keeping contact with London direct to War Office. And they said, "Right, you can come in and do the evening skit to London," which was a great honour for a field operator, you know. They just reserved this for the cream staff who acted as instructors to us, because we used to keep having tuition all the time to keep us up to scratch. And I sat up down in this air-conditioned palace and tuned up, and in came their signal, loud and clear, fine, beautiful. And I went to send back, and Captain Morgan, it was, their signals officer, they turned around, "Well, come on, send your signal." I said, "I'm sorry, I can't." "What do you mean you can't?" I said, "My hand won't handle the key." "Oh, rubbish." So Sergeant South, who was my mentor there, he turned around and said, "I think you'll have to get the other operator on, sir." So they got the regular sergeant on to the operating and took me off. Immediately called the doctor over. And he said, "Oh, yes, not surprised at all. All right, young Ellis, clear off to your hut." He said, "I'll see you sometime tomorrow." He said, "And don't worry about it at all," which is that nonsense, because you worry about it. And in the morning, I saw him.